It's now time for the Fantasy 411 Podcast.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Fantasy 411 Podcast. I'm Fred Zinke. I know that you're used to hearing Matthew Leach at the beginning of the podcast. This week, Matthew is off, so we found a terrific substitute. And I know there's no great substitute for Matthew Leach. If he's listening right now, Matthew, we could never really replace you, but we found a really great replacement for this week. I'll be honest, I listen to a lot of fantasy baseball podcasts. I've been listening to the CBS podcast for years. Al Melchior has been one of my fantasy idols in this industry for a long, long time. I'm really excited that we have Al with us this week. Al, welcome onto the show. It's great to have you. Maybe you can update people a little bit on, you know, where you've been since you left CBS, you know, a few months ago.
Sure, Fred. Well, thanks for that introduction. Really appreciate it. Well, I've been doing some work for MLB.com, working on some of the projections for the coming season and some player previews. I've been writing for FanRag Sports for the last 3 months, both on fantasy and on actual baseball. And recently also just started doing some work for FanGraphs, which I'm very excited about. So, all that is keeping me busy for sure.
Yeah, I love your actual baseball comment. You mentioned that to me when we were in a conversation a few weeks ago, that you're enjoying, you know, not just writing about fantasy baseball, but also writing about, you know, real baseball or actual baseball. I do find that fantasy baseball analysis and actual baseball analysis, I feel like they continue to bleed closer and closer together every year. Have you noticed that over the years?
Oh, absolutely, and I think it's a great thing. From the writer's perspective, it's definitely a gear shift. It's very tempting to just angle in that prediction of fantasy value where it's really not at all appropriate. So,
I totally agree. I think the use of advanced statistics is just, it's become more prevalent in actual baseball, you know, in front offices and fan analysis, and it continues to be more prevalent, all obviously, in fantasy baseball. It's the natural tendency of everybody looking to find a way to get an edge in both forms.
Yeah.
So I can see how you would enjoy that and how it would be an easy crossover. And we're going to start today with something that is real baseball, and that's that, as you know, probably every listener will know, a new CBA was reached last night. I know that they're still kind of finalizing some of the details, but it seems like all systems are go. And there's one aspect that I wanted to talk about a little bit today, and that's that the disabled list looks like it's going to move from 15 days to 10 days. Now, Alex, do you see some ways that could impact leagues next season?
I mean, in terms of drafting, no. In terms of in-season management, it may make some of those weekly lineup decisions a little dicier in terms of trying to determine when a player is returning. But I don't know. I mean, again, you know, we've already got the 7-day concussion DL. So we've already, you know, sort of got a different wrinkle in terms of dealing with DL time there. So I have a feeling it will impact it some way, but we just may not know what the exact implications are until we're, you know, actually in the thick of the 2017 season.
Yeah, when I first heard about it, there were two thoughts that kind of came to my mind. Both involve weekly transaction leagues and both involve starting pitchers, where I think you'll see the biggest impact. The first is obviously that that there is a scenario now where you could have a starting pitcher in your lineup in, you know, week A, have that pitcher go on the 10-day DL and never take him out of your lineup and have him in your lineup in week B because, you know, he goes on the DL on a Tuesday and he's back late the next week and you get him in a start on a Monday or a Tuesday, for example, before he goes on the DL, and then late the next week you get him on a start again off the DL. So it's not an automatic now when a pitcher goes on the DL that you have to take him out of a weekly lineup. The other thought that came to my mind is that teams are smart. I think that they're going to use this 10-day DL a little bit with their rotations to give pitchers sometimes extra rest. You know, you could have a pitcher just tired shoulder kind of thing, and you know, now with off days and the way you can shuffle rotations, you can put them on the disabled list and now have them miss just one start. And I could see that being a frustrating thing, maybe where an owner puts someone in a weekly transaction lineup. You know, they expect the pitcher, say, to start on a Thursday or a Friday. They get to that day, and they're going to go on the DL for 10 days. We backdated it to their last start. You know, they're just going to miss this one start. We shuffle the rotation a little bit, and they're going to be back next week, and then you end up with a zero for a week. I could see that happening sometimes, and it being frustrating for owners.
You know, that's a great point and one I hadn't considered, and it's almost like that 10-day window is made for that kind of strategy, you know. So, I think we probably will see a lot of that.
Yeah, and I don't think that's the reason they went to that. I think that the move to 10-day DL, like, I think it's a cool move for them because we don't want to get in a scenario where, you know, players with minor injuries are forced back quickly because they don't want to put them on the DL, but they don't want to have them out of the lineup for a week and have an empty roster spot. And we've seen that in recent years. So this 10-day DL makes it a little more forgiving for the guy, you know, with the little groin strain or the sore tight hamstring to go on the DL. I like it, and I think that's why they're doing it. But, yeah, I'm sure it won't take long for managers to realize that this is an easy way maybe sometimes to cap an innings, to, you know, get towards an innings cap a little slower or just pace a veteran a little bit. And I'm not saying the pitchers that go on the DL won't warrant a trip to the DL. I think a lot of pitchers could go on the DL for a lot of reasons at a lot of times once we hit the middle of the year.
That makes a lot of sense. And maybe there's less hesitation to DL a pitcher, whereas, you know, manager might wait with the 14-day or rather 15-day scenario to, you know, see how the pitcher's holding up, you know, after a few days beyond the injury.
Yeah, you're totally right. I hadn't thought about it from that angle, but that's a really good point. One of the worst things in fantasy baseball is to have your pitcher go out and have, you know, two or three really bad starts in a row, and then he goes on the DL, and then the team says, oh, yeah, he's been battling, you know, a sore shoulder for the last couple starts, but we were trying to let him work through it, and, you know, now we're going to shut him down for a while. And as a fantasy owner, you're thinking, man, couldn't you have told me that a couple weeks ago? I know you couldn't, but couldn't you have told me that before he ruined, especially in a roto league, like before he ruined my ratios? So that could be a good thing for fantasy owners if they put them on the DL, you know, like more quickly because they don't have to lose them for as long. Let's now move into some signings. We'll start with big news just this week, and that's Yoenis Cespedes staying with the Mets. Now, it's a big signing from a regular baseball perspective, big contract and everything, but from a Cespedes fantasy perspective, Al, I guess it doesn't really do much to change your opinion of him.
No, not at all. Yeah, same place, same player. So it's status quo. I think it's more sort of the outfield landscape around Cespedes that, you know, makes him sort of interesting. And I don't know that, you know, if he had gone someplace else, maybe to a team with a really stacked lineup, and I'm trying to think of, you know, an example of, you know, a team that would have had the need for him.
I thought of Toronto and Baltimore as two examples of, you know.
Baltimore would have been a very good example of that because, I mean, right now it's sort of unclear what sort of offense the Blue Jays will have. But, I think Baltimore would definitely be a clear, you know, big upgrade from what it appears the Mets would have. That would have been a slight upgrade just in terms of run production possibilities, plus the ballpark there. I wouldn't have seen a big change for Cespedes regardless of where he went.
Yeah, I kind of see it the same way. I always go back to a theory that I have that if a player's thriving in a situation, I love to see him stay in that situation, even if statistically, you know, ballparks and things like that, it's not the most advantageous situation. But he just seems to be comfortable since he's been with the Mets and has been productive. I mean, they were one of the lowest scoring lineups in baseball last season, and he was still quite productive. So I feel like they'll probably score more runs next year, almost by regression towards the mean. I don't think of the Mets as a bottom five lineup with him in it. So, I mean, you know, maybe they get Lucas Duda back for a whole year and Neil Walker for a whole year and everything, which would help. So I don't see Cespedes maybe in the first three rounds or so of a mixed league draft, but maybe after that. Do you think that's a, you know, maybe I'm gauging him properly, say about round four or so?
That's exactly where I think he should go, because when I look at how I would line up outfield rankings, there are eight outfielders I would definitely take ahead of him. And then after that, there's kind of a little mini tier, Cespedes would be, in my opinion, the best outfielder in kind of that next tier. And then there's just a big drop-off in terms of consistency, health, quality. So I really want to get one of the top, you know, 12 or 13 outfielders for sure. And of the ones that I would have outside the top eight, Cespedes would be the guy that I would target. So figuring that those top eight are probably going to be gone somewhere around the end of the third round, I think early fourth round is probably where Cespedes should go in most drafts.
Yeah, and I see him as a nice fit for teams. If you think fourth round, so you've had three picks. let's say you've taken one pitcher and one player who can steal some bases, and then, you know, I think of him as a nice fit for that kind of a team. And there'll be several of those teams in every draft when it comes to round four. You know, there'll be a few teams maybe by round four that need their first pitcher, or teams that need some steals. But if you've got some steals by that point in a pitcher, I think he's a great fit. Let's look at, you mentioned, you know, the trickle-down effect there with the Mets. They have a lot of outfielders, but it seems as though another transaction's coming. How do you see that outfield shaping up? Like, which one do you think will be the one to go?
I would say Jay Bruce. I mean, that to me seems like the obvious outfielder to move. The Blue Jays seem to be very, very interested in him. That's where I would expect him to go. But, I would just think that, you know, he's the one who's probably the least good fit to stay there.
Yeah, and Bruce to Toronto would be something, you know, we're trying to get too far into off fantasy and into these rumor speculations, but
right.
It would be a transaction that would, one of those transactions that would be good for everyone. He would be good for in Toronto. That's a good park probably for him. You know, he would be helpful for their lineup that really doesn't have much in the corner outfield right now. And then him leaving New York, I don't think would really cripple the Mets lineup, and it helps to ensure that, you know, Cespedes, Granderson, Michael Conforto, Juan Lagares, that they can all get, you know, a good amount of playing time. I guess Cespedes and Granderson play every day, and then Conforto and Lagares, you know, are the two of them are both in and out of the lineup. Would you draft Conforto in a mixed league right now? Like, assuming they move Bruce, then would you draft Conforto in a mixed league?
I would. I, you know, I'm not sure how that move would change his value, his perceived value in leagues. I would expect even then I could probably get him pretty late. And I think he's a great flyer. I really love the skill set that he has, the potential power that Conforto has. And the only real concern that I have is that platoon situation. So maybe in a points league, you know, where playing time, I think, is a little bit more important. Maybe not, but in a roto league, I would definitely target Conforto in the later rounds.
Yeah, I could see that. I don't think Lagares will be an everyday player next year. So if Bruce is gone, that leaves him with, you know, four outfielders. You know, that makes Conforto, you're right, like Conforto could be a platoon player, but I mean, sometimes these things work themselves out, and one of the four players spends time on the DL, and Conforto has stretches where he's playing every day. So, I mean, he has work to do from a personal perspective as far as just being productive. But you're right, I agree with you that I think he's a really interesting late-round flyer. You might know a couple weeks into the season whether you just want to drop him or keep him.
Sure, yeah, low risk, low cost.
Yeah, I'm going to group the next few signings kind of together on our list because, to me, we're going to talk about some starting pitchers that have signed in the past couple weeks. And to me, they're all unique but all similar in fantasy value. So Andrew Cashner wasn't very good last year. Now he's on the Rangers. Edinson Volquez wasn't very good last year. Now he's on the Marlins. Charlie Morton managed to avoid not being very good last year by not really pitching much last year, and now he's on the Astros. They're, you know, they're all not really appealing fantasy options, but out of the three of them, I wouldn't be surprised to see at least one of them emerge, at least as someone who could be a spot starter in mixed leagues. They've all had success at times before. Out of the three, which one maybe do you like the best?
To me, it's Volquez, and it's, look, he's not somebody that I'm really going to work hard to, you know, to target in a lot of leagues, but I just think he's the steadiest, the most likely to give you innings, and I think I do like the fact that Volquez is going to the Marlins because he's had some nice success in his home ballparks the last three seasons, the first of those at PNC and then the last two at Kauffman Stadium. He's allowed just 0.6 of a home run per nine innings over those three seasons combined. And Marlins Park, of course, a great pitcher's park, even still with the fences being moved in a little bit last year. You know, so if nothing else, I may not draft Volquez, but he's somebody I could see streaming during homestands, you know, and give you a good ERA.
Yeah, I could see that as well. But my concern with Volquez, it just limits his upside for me so much is that his whip seems to be, you know, consistently high. There's not much upside there, but I know what you mean. I could see with him back in the National League and at a pitcher-friendly park, I could see there being stretches of the season where you look at his next three or four starts and you just like the matchups. You're like, oh, he's got, you know, a home Phillies and then he's in San Diego after that or whatever. But I could see there being, if you're thinking about, you know, he's the one of the three that's in the National League, so I could see him having stretches where he has, you know, a favorable matchup. I'm interested to see how the NL East goes offensively next year. Four of the bottom five lineups, I believe, in runs scored last year were in the NL East. Now, his was one of them, so that doesn't really help him. And the Braves were one, but they were quite productive late in the season and seemed to be going in the right direction. So, we'll see. I still view the NL East as a pitching-friendly, you know, venue, like the overall division, but maybe it could trend back towards neutral. Now, out of the other two, you know, Morton and Cashner, is there one that you are just, you know, totally out on, or is there either one that you'd at least consider maybe even in a 15-team league, or if you were picking AL only, which one would you rather take a flyer on?
If it's AL only, I'll go Cashner. I just think there's still just maybe a shred of upside there with him, because even for a part of last season, he had really good control and a low whip. But he, just at this stage of his career, he still has yet to really kind of settle in as a particular, you know, profile, a particular type of pitcher. And, of course, not a lot of consistent quality either. So I'm not going to be very interested. I'm not going to be interested in either one in the 15-team mix league. And since, Fred, you and I are in one together, you know that I'm – he could be yours if you want.
I have a hunch that they will both – I don't know. I could see maybe Cashner, like, in a 15-team league in, the reserve round, but I can't see Morton at all. I totally agree with you about Cashner. We just don't – I feel like we don't know what he is, which is weird since he's been in the majors since 2010, but – you know, he's had spurts where he struck batters out at a solid rate, and then he's had spurts where he went way in the other direction, and the control was really good. And then last year, nothing was very good. And, you know, you thought, like, San Diego, that was pretty attractive overall setup for him the last few years in comparison to going to Texas now and going to the American League. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what he is. I'm with you. I don't really want him in a mixed league. In an AL only, though, where, you know, kind of anyone – you know, with a pulse gets drafted, then, or with a starting job at least gets drafted, I can see it. But yeah, we don't know what he is. I feel like he could be a real bust. Morton, I don't know. Morton, I think, can eat some innings for the Astros, although he hasn't been a great innings eater in his career, but his strikeout rate's just so low that I think the upside there is just really minimal.
Yeah, well, if there's one check in the Morton column, it's that I'm pretty confident that he'll remain a starter for all of next year. I think Cashner could wind up in the Rangers bullpen. Not that they're terribly deep in pitching, but the hot stove season is young. I know that the organization is open to having him in either sort of role. So that's something that does make me worry even a little bit more about Cashner. And I want to like Morton. I love the very high ground ball rate, but you know, just like Cashner, he's been around long enough that we've seen what the results are. And, yeah, they're nothing I want in the mixed league.
Yeah, the ground ball rate is nice, and that might help him on his move to the AL and deeper lineups. I mean, he might give up a few more hits, but, you know, if he can keep the ball on the ground, that could help him a little bit. It's just, yeah, it's just the upside there is so low. And then, I think the American League issue, I mean, maybe I would consider, if a Cashner or a Morton were going along fine, and they've both had stretches where they have done fine, even Morton with Pittsburgh at times was fine, you know, I could consider him on a, you know, a start against the A's or something like that. Even in a 15-team league, I might consider him at some point for a spot start, but I don't know. Volquez, at least I can see, like you mentioned, like I can see a path where maybe you actually want him in your lineup for multiple weeks in a row. Mm-hmm. And I guess, I guess that's the big difference. Now let's switch to some hitters. And I put Eric Thames at the top of, I know we did Cespedes because it's such a big story, but among the kind of lower tier signed hitters, because Eric Thames to me is just really, really interesting. And I'm really excited to get your take on him. I haven't really talked to anyone about him. I've read takes on him from a few writers, but I haven't really had a discussion about him. I saw him up close when he was with the Blue Jays for a while. Wasn't that impressed. His numbers from the Korea Baseball Organization are eye-popping, but you know, we've seen that go in either direction the last couple of years with guys that come over. What do you think about this signing? Like, do you think it's, from a baseball perspective, since you're doing some real baseball writing now, like, do you think this was a smart decision by the Brewers? And I guess really the answer to that question answers what you think about his fantasy potential.
Not necessarily. And I actually just wrote on this yesterday for FanRag. So I've given it quite a bit of thought. And so from a baseball perspective, from the Brewers' particular situation, I think it's a really smart move because they saved some money. And when you look at the total package, I mean, you look at what Chris Carter did in terms of power, and, yeah, I don't think Thames is going to come close to matching that, even though that's the strong part of his skill set. But I think that the overall package in terms of probably being a defensive upgrade, saving the money, which they can put towards some other areas, I think they could use better pitching. I think it's a good move because the target for them is at least 2 or 3 years down the road. And I think it helps them that way. Now, that's not anything that fantasy owners, unless maybe you're in a dynasty league with a, you know, some sort of salary system that you have to worry about. So I'm much less certain about what this means from a fantasy perspective. Like I said, I don't expect them to have 40 home run power. I actually think probably a 20 homer season is a more realistic expectation. Maybe about a 260-ish batting average like he had in that rookie year with Toronto. But, yeah, you look at the Korea numbers and how they've translated. Clay Davenport does the stat translations. And, you know, they're phenomenal even after getting – those numbers are phenomenal even after getting translated. But, of course, you know, every player is different. And he's a little bit different than, you know, other players that have come over from Korea in that he's faced major league pitching. So he's just a huge wild card who I think does have some upside. But from a fantasy perspective, I'm definitely going to take the conservative route, go with the track record that he's had in the major leagues and the minor leagues, and probably bypass him in 12-team mixed leagues, although the upside makes him, I think, potentially viable as a late rounder in those formats.
Yeah, so you're thinking kind of 12-team league, you know, maybe last round bench type guys, give him a couple weeks, see how it works out. But maybe his greater value is a 15-team league, maybe as your utility player, where it's easier to replace him if things aren't working out well in April. But maybe he is in a week one. I think he's going to be in a week one lineup in a lot of 15-team mixed leagues just based on the upside. And his stolen base potential is something that I want to make sure people don't overlook. You know, he did steal, I forget what the number was. He's averaging a good amount of steals per season, say about 20 steals a year in Korea. Now, who knows how that'll transfer over here, but the Brewers led the majors in steals last season, and it wasn't even close. And part of that is you know, speed on the roster, but part of that is also obviously a managerial decision. If he can steal, what do you think we could get from him next year, 10 to 15 steals?
That sounds about right to me. And that's a great point, by the way, too, about the organizational approach. Again, I would go conservative, but I don't think it's too conservative to think you could get 10 steals from them. And that makes something of a difference.
Yeah, I mean, with the way steals are at a premium right now, kind of across fantasy baseball leagues, and if he's going to be first base eligible, maybe not on opening day in some systems, but very quickly he will be. So, I mean, if you're looking at a corner infielder, you know, or your first baseman or utility player that can get you 15 steals when steals are at a premium, you know, that might be the way that you can then roster a power hitting middle infielder or something like that. I mean, I just think 10 or 15 steals will matter, and it may make up for the fact that he only hits, if he hits 20 to 25 home runs, you know, the steals kind of help make up for that. I'm thinking of also, even though he's not a first baseman, like a JT Realmuto kind of thing where he's a catcher and he derives some of his value from steals. You know, he hit for average last year, but bottom line with Realmuto is he makes up for the lack of power by having a few extra steals, and that generates more fantasy value. So I sometimes think of hitters as in their combined homers and steals. I try not to think about that with high steals guys because it gets a little wonky at that point. But for other hitters, sometimes I'll look at homers plus steals and what am I getting in that area, and that's a way for Thames to make up that value and maybe just be just as valuable as like a Lucas Duda type who isn't going to hit for average, might hit 25 or 30 home runs next year, but isn't going to steal any bases. Would you rather have someone like Duda?
Yeah, I think I would.
Yeah, I think I would too.
I kind of made a list of who I would take ahead of them. And there are 13 first basemen I consider must draft in standard mixed league, which doesn't leave a lot of room, obviously,
yeah,
for anybody else. But if you're talking about a roto league where, you know, there could be four, five, six or more first basemen, actually at least that many, because you probably have some in the utility slot, some in a first base or rather corner infield slot, you know, there's room, you know, for probably, you know, a total of 18 to 20, maybe even a few more in the league. And I think that's why I say he's a last-round possibility, because while I would take Duda over him, I would take Greg Bird over Thames.
Okay.
The list doesn't get much longer than that in terms of first baseman. I say, yeah, that's somebody I feel much safer about, and there's, you know, enough upside there. It's a pretty short list.
Yeah, yeah. When I was initially looking at him, And I just eyeballed it because, you know, the rankings aren't completely done yet. But I didn't really have him in the top 20 first baseman, but he was kind of around there, 20th, 22nd. You know, we'll see how it all shakes out once all the projections are done. But, and yeah, that adds up to, you know, maybe the last guy in a starting lineup in a 15-team league. And because he has the intriguing, you know, like Greg Bird does, you know, different circumstances for sure. But they're both boom or bust types that you can take at the end of a draft. Let's look at some other signings now. So Sean Rodriguez signed with the Braves. Short question here, Al. Do you think that he is on any mixed league teams next season?
Now, if you're including some deeper ones, you know, 14, 15 team, absolutely. In fact, in our 15-team league last year, I really kind of coveted him, but never had the right, you know, offered the right fit to make to, you know, to try to get him be a trade. So in that kind of league, I think he has a home. The problem is just that there's no clear place for him to play every day. And I think he, you know, has the bat and he has the versatility to get something close to full-time play. And what he did last year was pretty remarkable. I mean, 43.1% hard hit rate. The pop-ups were down. The walks were up. So if he can come even close to that kind of production, you got to think that he'll find his way into the lineup. But I just think there's enough uncertainty there with both playing time and with being able to carry over that level of performance for him to be drafted in a standard mixed league.
Yeah, I think that my concern with him is the ability to carry over the performance. But you made a good point about, you know, his surface stats from last year were well supported by, you know, him making some gains in his overall skill set. So that makes it more encouraging just than seeing, you know, no change and just a lot of his fly balls went for home runs unusually last year or something. But mm-hmm. So I like that. And, to a couple points to his credit, I'm not the biggest Rodriguez fan. I don't think I'll be the guy who ends up drafting him in a 15-team league. But if I wanted to make a couple points in his favor where I can see it, first of all, having a multi-position eligibility guy like him on your bench is terrific in any league, especially, though, in a deeper league where the waiver wire sometimes doesn't have what you need. And then the other thing is that the Braves don't have, you know, stalwart players at positions like second base and third base. You know, there are ways for him, if he's hot, there are ways for him to just get in the lineup every day, especially because Atlanta was trending, I mentioned that earlier, in the right direction offensively late last season. So if they can keep that going, you know, they've got, they've deepened their pitching staff. So I feel like it's not out of the realm of possibility that the Braves kind of hang around 500 for a lot of next season and feel like they're in a race. And at that point, if he's swinging the bat well, he could be their second baseman or something at some point.
Yeah, the problem is that the most likely places for him to play would be second and third, and there's prospects of both position, Ozzy Albies and Rio Ruiz, who I'm sure they want to get up to the major league level at some point. So it's very crowded, no matter how you look at it. But
yeah, absolutely. Does it make you say for, say, Adonis Garcia and Jace Peterson, like, are they less attractive to you now that Rodriguez is signed with the Braves?
Absolutely. And not that I would have been targeting either one in a standard mixed league, or probably not even a 15-team one, but they're even less attractive at this point, for sure.
Yeah, I agree. I think they're kind of off my 15-team league even list. So, and then for 10 and 12, they were already off. A lower profile signing on a much higher profile team is John Jay to the Cubs on a one-year deal. That one caught me a little off guard. I didn't see that one coming, although I guess the John Jay rumor mill isn't going to be particularly strong when there's players like Edwin Encarnacion and Mark Trumbo and Cespedes and Batista and all these players were on the market. But What did you think of Jay signing with the Cubs? He hits for average. He doesn't do a lot else. Is he NL only strictly, or do you think that he could get into mixed leagues?
I think there's some potential for deeper mixed leagues here. He had kind of an interesting season last year before he got hurt, hitting 26 doubles in roughly half a season. And the hard hit rate was up a bit to support that. But yeah, again, this is somebody who's sort of established himself, and I expect some regression there. And those doubles are really more of a thing that you're going to value in a points league than the Roto League, of course. So, I don't really see him as much of a factor in mixed leagues, certainly shallower than 15 or 16 teams.
Yeah, I feel like he's almost someone that I wouldn't want to draft in any mixed league. And in NL only, I like it, because in an NL only, that high batting average is nice. Like, it can help offset, you know, an Eric Thames or something like on your roster, or Chris Carter if he stays in the NL. But in a mixed league, I feel like the ceiling with Jay is just so low. And even though his splits are not very large in his career, I feel like he will share playing time. I feel pretty confident saying that he won't be an everyday player. But I think the value for me with Jay would be just that the Cubs will be really productive on offense. I'd be surprised if they're not a top five lineup in runs scored next year. And for me, the value with him is an injury replacement here for a week or two. You know, you have an outfielder out. You're looking for someone who won't hurt you. You pick him up. You hope he hits 300 while he's in your lineup, because he very well could. And then you maybe just hope that you run into the week that he steals a base or hits a home run. You know, you can't expect that to happen. But, you know, between homers and steals, I think he can get 13 to 15 or something next year, and you hope that you run into one. I think that's kind of all that you can expect from him. Same kind of maybe tier in my eyes, and I'm interested to see what you think, is Matt Joyce over in the AL now has gone to the A's. Do you like Joyce better than Jay?
I do, and they'll both likely be platoon players. I'm not sure that Jay and Almora will be a strict platoon.
Yeah.
But, you know, they'll be platooned in some way. So, Joyce's value is restricted somewhat by that. But I've always liked him, even when he's had a more reduced role, just because I like the power. I like the on-base potential. And, you know, I think that he can put up some pretty good numbers even in that platoon role. So, probably not enough for 12-team mix, but I'd say just about anything deeper than that, he's in play.
Yeah, I mean, Joyce is an interesting guy in that he was really going in a pretty good direction for a while with the Rays, and he had that year in 2011, 19 home runs, 13 steals, and he hit .277. And I remember there being, like, at 75 RBIs that year, like, there was a pretty good buzz about him that year. And then the next year, the batting average dropped off, but the power stayed. And then the next year, in 2013, the batting average stayed down and the power stayed and the steals then were down, obviously, because he's getting on base less and everything. And, you know, last year he came back up getting on base more, not really hitting for average, and the power was good last year. Oakland's not a great place for a power hitter, but we saw with Chris Davis last year, and he's not the only one who's done this recently, but we saw with Chris Davis last year, like, you can have a power hitter on the Oakland A's and he can still be really productive.
Yeah, and playing those years at Tropicana Field, pretty challenging environment for a power hitter, so I'm not too worried about the park factor.
Yeah, he's never played on a team that we would classify, like, he, you know, was briefly with the Angels, was briefly with the Tigers, was briefly with the Pirates. He's never played on a team with a hitter-friendly park, so I don't think that's really going to Oakland's a knock against him. How many home runs do you think? Maybe high teens?
Yeah, I was thinking 20-ish.
Yeah. And then a batting average around 250.
Maybe taking the under is the smart thing, taking the under on 20. You know, the environment might have a little bit of a dampening effect and the playing time, probably when you put that all together.
Yeah, and a batting average probably. His career average is .242. I feel like there's nothing in his recent history to suggest that I think that he's going to stray that far from there.
Yeah.
So I guess but what would be nice, if he's in a platoon and it's strict, and I think it will be, you know, you can probably look at the days ahead on the schedule in a weekly transaction league, and that makes him nice to own, I think. You're not guessing. You're right with Jay. If the platoon isn't strict, then you're really guessing maybe sometimes week to week as to how many starts he's going to get. But with Joyce, you should know going into the week whether this is going to be like a 3 or 4 game week and he's on your bench, or whether this is going to be maybe a 5 or 6 game week for him.
Yeah. And if I could just backtrack to Jay for a second, one thing I wanted to mention was that there was a report I saw just this morning that the Cubs are actually still in on re-signing Dexter Fowler. So it's kind of a crazy situation that seems like it could go one of several ways. So, you know, fortunately none of us, I think, are drafting yet.
Yeah.
But if, you know, you were to speculate on Jay right now, I mean, you'd have to be very, very careful because – even just the platoon considerations aside, it seems like the roster moves there in Chicago, they're far from done.
Yeah. Now, I will say, and I have openly admit to having 0 days experience running a Major League Baseball franchise, but lots of days experience following them, and I would be shocked if the Cubs did bring back Fowler. I read some of the same articles that you read about them. You know, they definitely gave lip service. They're open to it, and they made a good point that this time last year they weren't expecting to bring him back. But man, after if he can't get a multi-year contract after winning the World Series with them, I would be really surprised. I know he has a draft pick tied to him still, but I really think he's going to get the at least 4 years. And a good salary, and that's not coming from the Cubs, I don't think. Like, I would be really surprised if he's back with the Cubs.
I was surprised to see it, but I think maybe it is part of a bigger master plan to bring in a former Cardinals outfielder every offseason and also bring Fowler back. So next
maybe.
Year, maybe Matt Holliday and Randall Grichuk the year after that.
It's their way of beating the Cardinals both on and off the field. You know, kind of just beating them and then just twisting the knife a little bit in the off season and saying, oh, we got another one of your beloved former players. Maybe. I don't think that's probably not a topic of discussion that often in the Cubs front office, but maybe once in a while they talk about it. Now
it would seem that way.
Yeah. There's with only really been one recent trade of note that really has a lot of fantasy potential, but I'm excited to talk to you about it because it involves the Mariners, and I feel like since you've moved to Montana, you have a little more vested interest in the Mariners. You can correct me if I'm wrong about that, but you seem to really be, in your writing, really getting to know the Mariners even deeper than you did before. So I'm interested on your take on, because I think it's a little different than mine, on the Gene Segura, Taiwan Walker deal where they threw in some other parts to keep us all excited, but really I think those are the two main pieces. First of all, what do you think of Segura now that he's with the Mariners?
I don't think the value changes, you know, just in terms of environment, in terms of team. You know, I just don't think there's a lot of change there, and I think the change that probably a lot of people are expecting is just flat-out regression. But, you know, this is somebody, you know, who is still, you know, relatively young, and had a breakthrough season that was backed by all the indicators that you want to see it, you know, see that backed by, you know, hitting with more power, you know, just in improving a lot of different aspects of the game. So, I think that Segura is, well, first of all, I think it's just a great fit for the Mariners because they were desperately looking to upgrade at shortstop, both offensively and defensively, and I think they absolutely have achieved that, much more so than if they had gone out and gotten Zach Cozart, which they tried to do. So, again, that's more from a real baseball perspective. But, again, back to fantasy, I fully expect that Segura is going to be one of the top shortstops again, and that's a pretty a pretty big call to make given the landscape at shortstop because, you know, a couple of years ago it was pretty barren. But all of a sudden you have all these young up-and-coming shortstops who have been pretty much as good as advertised, you know, whether it's Lindor, you know, Correa, Corey Seager, you know, Trevor Story, much better than advertised, Lourdes Diaz. And Segura's right there with all of those players. So I think he maintains that value because of the skills, and it doesn't get hurt by the move.
Yeah, I think he'll be productive, you know, at the top of their lineup, and he definitely is something that they needed and were looking for. I'm going to ask you a couple just quick questions to see kind of maybe where you're thinking. So 30 steals over under, where would you go with that?
I will take
last year.
I'll take the under. I'll take the under on that.
Yeah, and say for a batting average, 290. So last year was 319.
Yeah, I think I'm going to take the over, and I'm really thinking hard on this because this is somebody I don't know if I should be saying this or not. I don't know if you can edit this, Fred. I've done the projection on him.
Okay, that's fine.
So I'm pretty sure I went somewhere in the 290s with
him. Yeah, I think that makes sense. Yeah.
So,
go ahead.
Yeah, so I'm almost positive I took the over. In fact, I'm trying to remember now if I went over 300. I don't think I did, but I think, yeah, right around 290, 300 is what you can expect.
Yeah, to me, the steals will be the really interesting factor. He stole 33 last year. The Diamondbacks were aggressive stealing. I believe that they attempted exactly twice as many steals as the Mariners did last year. And you can say, I would accept an argument that that's partially based on personnel. At the same time, like when we see the Diamondbacks just letting Paul Goldschmidt loose on the bases last year, like this is a franchise first baseman, and they're just letting him run, you know, 32 steals last year. That seems to be now a philosophy that they were willing to be aggressive last year. So I'm interested to see if, I think we'll find out with his steals total, you know, are the Mariners not aggressive on the base paths by design, or were they not aggressive on the base paths last year because that's what their talent fit? And I can see, looking at their individual players and their steals totals last year, mm-hmm. I could go either way on that. And I think his steals total this year will tell that tale.
Yeah, that's a good point. And if you want to be discouraged, you know, you can look at Ketel Marte's lack of stolen base production, particularly as compared to the roughly half season that he played in 2015 with a different manager. So that's a good point. And yeah, no, the Chip Hale was definitely, you know, one of the more aggressive managers of the last couple of years when it came to base running. So, but I think Segura's speed translates to just about anywhere. Maybe not Baltimore, where it seems like nobody runs.
Yeah.
But just about.
Yeah. No, I agree.
I would think. I think he'd be good for about 25 plus.
Yeah, I couldn't come up with a real, like, firm grasp on the Mariners' decision-making. I did note, like, there's a few guys, like, Robinson Cano used to be good for a handful of steals. He only attempted one stolen base last year. Now, that could just be, like, an age kind of thing, and they're just trying to protect him and keep him healthy. Like, I would totally get that. He's not Gene Segura. That's a different skill set. But, you know, but, again, it's a cautious approach. You know, Leonis Martin had 24 steals last year, but, you know, he's someone who had a couple 30-steal seasons with the Rangers, and he hit about as well last year as he did during those times with the Rangers. So I don't know if the 24 was them being cautious with him, and his success rate was quite high. So I thought maybe with his success rate, he could have been up to 30. But, yeah, we'll see with Segura. I'm comfortable with something in the mid to high 20s, and then we'll go from there. Now, let's look at the other big piece in the deal, Taijuan Walker, who's been a really up and down and frustrating at times fantasy pitcher recently. How do you feel about him in Arizona?
I feel pretty good about him in Arizona. I think that's, you know, could be a more challenging ballpark. And for somebody whose biggest problem has been the home run, that is a little concerning, but I'm much more interested in how he comes back from the foot and ankle procedure that he had done, really, than the change in park effects. I think that's going to be, his health is going to be the much bigger determinant. And in a way, I don't even worry about it that much, because he at times has had such good command and control that, you know, I just think if he's healthy and well, that even if he gives up a few home runs, Walker is going to be more than fine. So he's another one that it's more so than the environment, more so than the team he's going to. I'm more concerned about some of the other factors in terms of his performance.
Yeah, I think the park effect probably is offset by the league effect, and then it all comes back to, you know, how well is he actually pitching? Because he's someone who's shown that when he's going right, he can be very good, and then. But he hasn't been able to keep that going, you know, for a while. Now, I threw out, when I sent you an email yesterday to kind of get ready for the show, I threw out a whole bunch of names of other players who may be impacted from this deal but aren't really big fantasy people, whether it's Ketel Marte, whether it's Shelby Miller or Archie Bradley or Braden Shipley or Patrick Corbin, or is Nathan Carnes going to get a chance now in the rotation? And it's too early in the offseason, really, to say for a lot of these players, but you know, because both these teams, especially the way the Mariners have been going, are going to make more transactions. But, you know, out of all those names I just threw out, you know, are there any of them that you see as someone who you're really keeping a close eye on to see, you know, what their role is going to be and maybe could be a sleeper next year?
Well, you mentioned Carnes, and I have to like his chances right now. Though, as you said, Mariners are making lots of moves. So right now it would appear he's penciled into the rotation, but who knows, you know, even a week from now how that looks. I hope he is. I think he could be a good starter for the Mariners. As far as the Diamondbacks rotation situation, which is pretty crowded, I just hope that they can find some way to find a spot for Patrick Corbin, because he finished really strong last year in the bullpen, seemed to be kind of back on his feet after a lot of struggles. And he was all right initially in 2015 coming back from Tommy John. So it was sort of a surprise to see Corbin be really pretty bad in the first half of 2016. But he finished strong, and I think that he could be a really good number three starter for them. So, yeah, I'd like to see Corbin get a shot there. And as far as Marte goes, that's also an extremely crowded situation in the infield there for the Diamondbacks. And I would suspect that he probably starts here in AAA. Again, no real information there, just a hunch, and just, you know, looking at who else they have on the roster. I did read that they want to give Brandon Drury more plate appearances next year. I think that'd be a great thing. You know, Chris Owings there, Nick Ahmed, you know, with the certainly the defensive value. It's hard to see where Marte fits.
Yeah, I was never, maybe even last year, not as high on Marte as some other people were, but and now I'm not. I'm even less excited. Out of all of them, I felt like Corbin was the one that stuck out to me, so I'm glad you mentioned him. Just, I was surprised by his struggles last season. We'll see if he's just not the same pitcher anymore, but like you mentioned, he had a strong finish in the bullpen, but when he initially came back from Tommy John and was okay, then I thought, okay, we're good now, because he had been fine, he had been good before that surgery. So yeah, he's someone I'm keeping an eye on, and I think if he has a rotation spot, he's a nice little boomer bust, like late round, put him on your bench, see how he does at the beginning of the season kind of pick. Definitely, I don't mind Carnes, but I don't know. I think I'm going to have to, I would probably lean, I could lean towards not drafting him in a mixed league, and I wouldn't be surprised if there's a lot of competition there by the end of the winter. The Mariners have just been making a lot of moves. I feel like other starters will still be coming there.
Yeah, and they really needed depth, which they've, you know, they've built up a little bit with some of their recent trades. Yeah, I don't know. I suspect that there'll be some even higher quality starting pitchers coming their way in the weeks to come. But I think Carnes deserves to be in that conversation for really number four starter, because, well, I think Ariel Miranda is pretty good. I don't know that he's necessarily better than Carnes.
Yeah, I agree with that too. All right, well, we've gone a few minutes over time, but that's okay because it's the off season. People have a lot of time to listen. There aren't a lot of podcasts this time of year. So, you know, thanks everyone for listening. And, you know, to quote Matthew Leach, you couldn't be with us this week. Thanks, Al Melchior, for taking some time to talk.